Welcome to episode 34 of Linux Matters, recorded on 3rd of July 2024. This is a podcast featuring three experienced open source professionals as we discuss the impact Linux has on our daily lives. I'm Alan, and I recently launched a newsletter that I'd like you to all subscribe to. I'd like to tell you about.
Hello, I'm Mark, and I have a quick update on Quick GUI.
Hello, I'm Martin, and I've been hacking old hardware to make a new HomeLab server.
I started a self-hosted personal newsletter.
What's that, like a blog?
Yeah, kind of. Now you say it like that. Why did I do this? The thing is, I wanted to have a way of writing stuff, and I quite fancied creating a newsletter because it's very personal, and the only people who read it are the people who subscribed, so they actually want to read it. And if they don't want to read it anymore, they don't subscribe. It's as simple as that. Mm-hmm. And normally I post little bits and pieces on social media, but I've started to feel that social media is a bit rubbish and some of the stuff isn't long enough to be a blog post, but it's a bit longer than a social post. Mm-hmm. And I don't really like doing a thread of social posts, like a succession of them.
Thank you for not liking that.
Also, I mostly use Mastodon, which the user interface in the app I use doesn't actually do that very well. At least on Twitter, you could like press plus and add another one and plus and add another one, whereas the app I use doesn't do that. But it doesn't matter. That's irrelevant. You don't need to write in and tell me there's better ways to do it, because I'm not going to do that because I've made a newsletter. I used a piece of software called ListMonk, which I'd played with on my workstation before. It's a single Go binary, and it's designed for really like marketing campaigns, like people doing like proper email campaigns to people with lots of versatility and robustness. And it's very simple to use, but it really feels like something that's designed for multiple mailing lists and many users. Like it talks about the performance and how it can send many, many emails. I'm not sending anywhere near the amount of capacity that this thing can send. I'm sending a few emails.
I love the whole, it's a single Go binary, or in some cases, it's a single Rust binary. Back in the day, I operated a mailing list thing for work, and it was, I don't know, a backyard of PHP and a colossal database. So my question is whilst it might be a single binary, are there significant or complicated database requirements?
No, it's Postgres, and the instructions that I followed were really straightforward. It was, you know, create a database, run some commands, and it works. And there's a single config file for ListMonk itself, mm-hmm. in which you put the database details and admin user and password and all that kind of stuff. That's it. The rest of it is set up in ListMonk's web UI that has loads of settings. So it's got a web interface. I go to the admin, and in there I can create a newsletter and manage the subscriber list and create a campaign and preview what it's going to look like and send test emails and all the kind of stuff you would need from a mailing list or newsletter.
So Mark likened this to creating a blog. How sort of creating a blog post like is this in their web UI?
I mean, if you're familiar with like WordPress or mm-hmm. something like that, it's got a WYSIWYG editor. Mm-hmm. So you could do a rich text, or you could do Markdown or HTML if you want to. I generally edit in Markdown in an external editor because I'm familiar with whatever text editor I happen to be using at the time. And then as ideas come up, I put them in the note and then revise it over the week. The idea being it goes out on a Friday, but I have it ready before Friday. So this week's, we're recording this on a Wednesday. It's mostly written. So I'll just send it on Friday. And you can schedule it as well. But you can either edit directly in the web UI, or you can maintain it externally and then paste it in. And there's a preview button. Like I said, you can send a test email. So I can see what the email will look like by sending it to myself or a spare email address. So it's very straightforward, actually. It's really easy to use. It's not really hard, but a tricky part is sending the emails, because sending emails on the internet, you have to send it through some kind of mail server, really. You can't send it directly. So I use SendGrid as the way that my emails go out.
Right.
I'm on the free tier. I don't think I'm ever going to touch the sides. I'm not going to get lots and lots of people subscribe to this thing. It's once a week, you know, a few emails go out. It's fine. The hard part is actually formatting it, because I want it to render in an email mm-hmm. in the way that I want it to render. And email clients are notorious for being a little bit tricksy with the way they render stuff. And I also want to render it in an archive online, so people who don't want to subscribe via email can see it on a web page,
yeah,
or use their RSS reader. And so there are separate templates you can use and separate style sheets you can use, one for email, one for archive online. And you can have as many of those templates as you like. So, you know, if you had lots of mailing lists and lots of different types of subscribers, then you could have lots of different templates, but you can have two separate templates, one for the email, one for the online archive, if you're using that.
And does ListMonk actually serve that archive as well, or does it just generate the files which you then deposit somewhere?
Yes, it actually serves the files itself. It is a web server as well. And so when you visit the URL newsletter.popey.com, you are hitting ListMonk.
Okay.
And it is serving the files up. And there's some, you know, files you can edit, the CSS files. You could just go and edit them. They're on the file system, some of them, the base ones. Mm-hmm. But most of it you can just do in the web UI. And it's very fast to turn around. You just like edit something and press show me what it looks like. And it shows you a little window that looks like an email, mm-hmm, and renders it really, really nicely. It's actually a really pleasant experience. It's actually more pleasant than writing blog posts in Hugo.
Because you've got the immediacy of sort of seeing, yes, the rendered version and doing the whole live preview thing without,
exactly,
having to,
exactly,
go through that like little dance of running a local instance and all the rest of it.
Yeah. And I had to learn a little bit more CSS stuff because I wanted to format the email in a very particular way. Mm-hmm. I didn't want blue links in my emails.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it doesn't obey the style sheet. You have to do inline CSS. And so I'm doing a bit of inline CSS in order to turn the links black because I want the whole thing black and white, monochrome, a bit like a typewriter kind of thing. And there's limited fonts you can use and,
right,
you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I've tried to make it a bit retro, a bit, it's monospace font. I quite like it. I really like the process of doing it. It means I'm exercising my creativity and my writing, but I don't have to write an entire long blog post. I can just write a few little snippets. I've sent one out so far and had some feedback, and the feedback's been nice, very pleasant, and it's been archived as well, so people can go and view it. If you just go to newsletter.popey.com, there's a button, and you can just see the old, every one that I post, however many there will be, who knows? I'll get bored of this next week. They all appear there online. It's as simple as that.
So Mark likened this a little bit to sort of writing a blog post. So how does your newsletter content and style differ from a blog post? And when will you sort of decide what represents a blog post and what is something you'd put in a newsletter?
That is a very good question. Short snippets that would have been social media posts are in the newsletter. I started writing something the other day and it got very, very long in the newsletter. And I thought, nope, this is too long, and cut it and pasted it into a separate document that will become a blog post.
Right.
So if it gets too long and I'm being too verbose and I have to go into a lot of detail about what it is, then sure, that'll be a blog post. But if it's just four or five sentences about a thing or asking for help, which I did in the first one, I asked for help and very quickly got multiple responses from people, useful feedback. So that's great. And I didn't have to worry about comments on the internet because, mm-hmm, there are none. It's personally sending me emails.
That's an interesting point.
And so I don't have to worry about arguing with weirdos online who disagree with my life choices, because if you don't want to see what I've written, you won't subscribe to the newsletter and you won't visit the archive, and I win by you not reading it if you don't want to have a conversation with me. But if you do and you subscribe, you can read it and then, you know, go on with your life or send me an email or something, which is very nice.
Were you inspired to do this by other people writing and publishing newsletters that might be worth a mention here?
No. Well, yes and no. After I decided I was going to do this, I then went around looking at what other people do,
right, yeah,
to see how people format them and whether there's anything special people do, like in the file name or the subject line or something like that.
Yeah.
And I had to think carefully about what the subject line of the email is and what the URL to the archived thing would be and stuff like that. Yeah, that kind of stuff, to see, you know, yeah, what looks good and what looks bad and what's a good way of doing it and what's a bad way of doing it. I am inspired by two things. One was NTK, needtoknow.net, which predates probably most people and is a newsletter style. If you go to ntk.net, it's monospace
from the proper past as well.
Yeah, it's from the proper past. It hasn't had an issue for, what, a long time?
Right, okay.
Over a decade. But it was really good. The Beta newsletter, I looked at that as well. And there's another one that I won't mention, which has grown-up content. So yeah, I did get some inspiration from a few that are also similarly monospaced, narrow typewriter newspaper style. And I'm really enjoying it. And there'll be a link to it in the show notes, but don't feel compelled to subscribe.
I think this is a good shout. So ListMonk is a software you're using.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, you see, like, you know, independent content creators use off-platform mailing lists to actually establish sort of direct contact with the people that are interested in what they're doing.
Yeah.
And if, like me, you've been working at a startup anytime soon, you know that having a mailing list / newsletter capability is absolutely essential to how you sort of build and reach your audience. So I think there's a number of different reasons why people might be interested in this other than a more tasteful way to engage with people online.
I also wanted it to be positive only, a bit like this podcast. I didn't want to put any politics in there or, you know, start arguments online with my strong opinions or anything like that. It's just, you know, stuff that's going on. I separated it into three sections, like stuff I've created, stuff I've consumed, and then some comment section about stuff I'm thinking or concerned about or stuff that's going on. It's not, you know, life-changing. It's just a little thing for you to read on a Friday if you want to. And if you do want to, there'll be a link in the show notes, newsletter.popey.com. Although I also registered newsletters.popey.com because I sent one out with the wrong URL, so I had to quickly update my DNS. So you will notice if you go to either newsletters or newsletter.popey.com, you'll get to the same place. Don't worry about it. It's fine.
On a recent episode, I spoke about Quick GUI and mentioned that I was feeling a bit guilty that I hadn't given it much love. And I thought maybe I should go back and make some improvements and merge some pull requests and so on. So I did.
Martin nerd sniped you into touching it again, did he?
Might have done. That was a brilliant episode, that last one, for getting stuff done.
Yeah. So one of the questions that you asked me towards the end of that discussion was how easy it would be to get back into the code after a while. And I now have the answer to that question. So I couldn't remember how I set up the development environment. So I went looking at the instructions for developing Flutter on Linux. And it says, you can either use VS Code, here's the link, or you can use Android Studio, go and find it. So I thought, well, VS Code is obviously the recommended way. So I installed VS Code and the extension. And it works, but it's a bit janky. As I often find with VS Code, it kind of has that bag of spanners approach of, yes, you've got a good editor, but then whatever you want, you've got to plug lots of things in, and some of them work really nicely and some of them don't work so well. So I then went back to Android Studio, which I then remembered was what I used in the first place, which is a lot more integrated experience for developing Flutter apps. Has really good integration with the debugger, has a nice element inspector, much like you have when you're developing a web page and you open the developer tool. So you can click a thing in your app and it shows you an inspection of that widget with, you know, all of its properties. And as I suspected, because it's all declarative and everything on the page is sort of composed of bits that are nested inside each other, it is very easy to get back into it. And in fact, I was able to go poking around in the bits which were originally written by Yannick, which I hadn't really looked at in detail much before, and make some changes there quite easily as well. So that was the good news, certainly.
The good news, you were sounding very singular there.
Sorry, no, I didn't mean to sound negative. That was some good news to start me off.
Excellent.
So in terms of the actual changes that have been made, the first thing I did was merge in a pull request to update the Dart and Flutter SDKs to the newer versions, and to therefore fix a load of deprecations which had come in. So often when you update the APIs that your application's based on, things will have changed in those APIs. Things will be there, but they're no longer supported and something else replaces them. That's called deprecation. So I basically went through and merged in a load of changes that fixed some of those, and then went through in Android Studio. It highlighted them. I could link through and find out what I should do instead, and basically just have it doing the same thing, but in a more up-to-date way.
You didn't have to like actively go and read a bunch of documentation to go and figure out how to do it. Was it pretty semi-automatic? Or
a few of them were literally just, you know, you clicked it and it said, I'll do this instead. Quite similar to Go, the development of Dart is quite encapsulated. There's like one set of tools for doing things the way that you do things in Dart. So that means that it's quite easy to find the new way of doing things and migrate to that. But yeah, there were a few things where it was like I had to look up the documentation for the old function and then find out what it said it had been replaced with, and then, you know, work out what parameters I needed to pass. But that was fairly straightforward. The more exciting thing I did was actually make some performance improvements to the app itself. So running the app, there were a couple of big issues that stood out. The first was the slow startup time. And the second was that when you go to download an image to create a VM, it tries to display an icon for each one. And it was throwing a load of errors in the debug log and also not displaying a default image if one wasn't available. So the first thing I did was address the issue with the icons by preloading them at the start and working out which ones existed and which ones didn't, so they properly display a default icon and wouldn't throw errors when they tried. And then also reused those icons in the VM manager page. So if you've got an Ubuntu VM, it has the Ubuntu logo. The second thing was looking at the startup time. So I think we discussed before that what it's doing there is it's asking QuickGet to give it the list of available VMs. So then when you go to download them, it knows what you've got. And what it was doing was it was starting up the application, calling QuickGet, and then waiting for QuickGet to finish outputting and then carrying on.
So it was blocking the UI, was it?
That's exactly right, what it was doing.
Oh, I'm a developer.
I resolved that by making it asynchronous. So now it still does that when you start up the application, but then that runs in the background. And if you get to the VM download page before it's finished loading, it now displays a spinner to say it's getting the list of VMs. But, you know, it's a few clicks away, so it might have finished by then. And then as soon as it's got them, it displays them. And this is actually really easy in Flutter. There's a mechanism in Dart called futures for calling asynchronous code, which is very similar to promises in JavaScript. You basically say something is happening in the background. It will have some data at some point, and I'll tell you when. And then you can carry on doing your application and have something happen once it has data. And in Flutter, it has a thing called future builders. And what that lets you do is create a UI which says, here is the future, which will have some data. When it doesn't have any data, show this. And when it does have data, do this with the data and show something else.
Nice. That's completely understandable. I like that.
Yeah, it's really easy, really, really nice to do. Easier than doing it with JavaScript, in fact. So the upshot of this is the app now loads instantly. And if you're just running VMs, you don't see any delay at all.
Nice.
Yeah, so I would say that since Mark made those changes in the using of QuickGUI, I have never had to wait for that rendering to happen. By the time you click on, I want to make a machine, it has pulled in all of that information and it just is seamless. There is never any waiting around or spinners or anything. It's just happening. So it's great. And the other thing I did is I looked at everything that Mark had done and I built up a list of all of the bugs that existed in the bug tracker, and one evening went through and tested them all. And it turns out that in just, well, I say just two, they were significant bits of work, but in two of the commits that Mark made, I think like 30 of the bugs that had been reported were wrapped up as being fixed in, nice. In two of those commits. So I went through and tidied up the issue tracker with this has been fixed here, here, and here.
So yes, other people helped, one of which was Martin, as well as triaging issues. You've been doing some work with the build and release process, so that's now automated.
Yeah.
So we can click a button in GitHub and we get a deb push to the PPA and a Nix flake push to the Nix place and so on. Codsius, I'm going to pronounce that. I need to thank for the pull request, which did this initial load of updating the Dart and Flutter API stuff. And also Yannick, my original co-conspirator, is working on a macOS port. We discussed before that QuickEMU now works on macOS, and with Flutter being a cross-platform toolkit, you can build a Flutter app for macOS. I never bothered trying before because it wouldn't have done anything, but it should theoretically be possible to have QuickGUI work just the same on macOS as it does on Linux. So, yeah, we'll see how that goes in the future.
I'd like to point out I was also part of the QA team. Martin wandered around to my office and went, "Oi, install this." And I installed it and I was like, "Yep, that works. And it seems to be working okay on my laptop." He's like, "Okay." And he walks off. I think what he should have done, or what I should have done, is said to him, "Send me a link to the issue and I will report it there. And then I get the credit on GitHub for actually contributing by doing my testing and not just him coming around and tapping me on the shoulder and telling me to install something."
There wasn't an issue for what I was asking you to test, as Mark alluded to.
You should have filed one then, shouldn't you?
Spurred on by Mark's sort of refreshing of the app, I added a thing called Flutter Distributor, which builds the app and makes DEBs and RPMs and app images and da-da-da-da-dum. And I added all the Nix magic because that's what I care about now. Mm. And what I was asking you to test specifically is, does the DEB that it build install, do the right thing, you know, does the install work? And that did. So as a result of all of Mark's hard work, there is now Quick GUI 1.2.9 released on GitHub and in the PPA and everywhere you need it. So you can come and get it and enjoy the new version.
So Mark, will you continue to contribute, or is this one of those things that now you've got it over the line and it works, like, let other people deal with it?
I do intend to kind of keep on keeping it up to date. As I use it as well, I'll revisit it. And I mean, again, there's not much more I need to add in terms of features, unless Quick MU suddenly starts doing other things that it needs to support. But, you know, I'll keep it looking nice as best I can into the future.
Nice.
I was inspired by Mark's recent creation of a new home server and decided to build a new Homelab server of my own using some hardware from the past.
How far in the past? Is it a Commodore 64?
No, not quite that past. It is built from a workstation I made in 2018. So relatively modern and sort of in keeping with what we talked about here in terms of sort of, you know, keeping old stuff going or handing it on to people, being responsible with the stuff you have. Which is also a topic we touched on in Ask the Hosts a couple of episodes ago. So if you're not subscribed to Ask the Hosts, you should go and dig that one out as a subscriber to the Late Night Linux family. So I had all of this hardware, but what I actually needed in order to complete this was a case to put it in. So that's where the story starts, is like assembling the old workstation in a new case and then turning into something that is a server.
Is it a Commodore 64 case?
I do have several of those, but no, I decided to go with something a little bit more industrial.
Okay. More industrial than a Commodore 64. Okay.
Yes, significantly more industrial. So the case I went for, there's a company in the UK called Silverstone Tech, and they make cases. A lot of people might be most familiar with their cases for sort of home theater PCs. I think that's where they sort of became popular in the early days.
Yeah, my first Steambox was a Silverstone HTPC case.
Right. And in fact, my current workstation here is also one of their HTPC cases, not because it's an HTPC, but because it fits in the form factor of the racking that I have here in order to just get a PC in that orientation. So yeah, it's an RM44 4U chassis. And the reason I got this is it's absolutely cavernous inside. And it's not that I needed lots of space for spinning discs, as we'll learn later, but I really did want to solve a cooling problem.
When you say it's cavernous inside, I mean, it's going to be 4 U's high and 19 inches wide, surely.
Yes, it is 4 U's high and 19 inches wide. And that is a lot of space to build, like, you know, a PC in when you're not putting any disks into that space.
Oh.
But what I did put into that space that I already had from when it was a workstation is a 360mm all-in-one liquid cooler for the CPU. So to visualize what that looks like, the 360mm comes from the fact that it has three 120mm fans on the radiator. And then it's a thick radiator block. And we'll get to why I was going tonto with the cooler. I added another three fans to that in a push-pull configuration. So there's three fans on the front of the radiator pulling air across the radiator fins, and another three fans that I've added on the back of the radiator pulling air out the other side as well, in order to get sort of maximum airflow across the radiator fins to keep that radiator cool.
Is the speed of the fans regulated in some way?
That is an excellent question. And one of the reasons I did this is because more fans at a lower speed generates more air pressure at lower noise.
Right.
So you could have fans that ramp up and down as the temperature changes. But if you get the volume of air outpacing the heat accumulation that it needs to deal with, you can have static air pressure at a fixed RPM. So in this case, all of those fans are configured to run at about 800 RPM each, but there's six of them, which generates lots of static pressure and airflow across the radiator stack and is basically silent. And it doesn't drift, which is what our audio producer likes, because he doesn't have to combat a change in hum tones in the background noise of the audio, because this thing sits next to me in this room.
Nice.
So aside from fans, what else is in the case?
And the heatsink. Don't forget the heatsink.
Yeah, indeed. Well, the heatsink's irrelevant because it's not a heatsink. It's just a water block that sits on top of the CPU. But all of this talk of fans and coolers is kind of burying the lead, because this workstation had an i9-9900K CPU in it, which back in the day was known for two things. It was, at that time, the world's fastest gaming CPU, don't you know, but also famous for generating more heat than the surface of the sun and being impossible to cool. And one of the reasons why I stopped using it is it generated so much heat in this room, I couldn't work here during the summer. This is why I started going to another office with air conditioning, because it was so ungodly hot in here. And that radiator that I was just telling you about was basically just turning into an actual radiator. It was absorbing all of the heat that this CPU was creating and heating the room up in the middle of summer. Now, that CPU part, the 9900K, is technically a 95-watt TDP part, which is thermal design something or other. Requires 95 watts of power, allegedly, and therefore that's the amount of heat that you need to deal with. But actually, this is a lie, because this was when Intel were trying to combat the new generation of AMD CPUs with just raw, ungodly performance. So they'd got an old CPU design, and that 95 watt part, I've actually measured consuming over 160 watts under sort of peak load, which is where all of this heat comes from. So I wanted to use old parts, and I wanted something low power, neither of which this was.
Fail.
But the motherboard that I had, which is a Designer Z390 for completeness, is a motherboard that's capable of overclocking, which is lovely. But it also means it's a motherboard capable of underclocking, or specifically undervolting. And I went and looked at the Intel Arc database of CPUs, and the 9900K family has one part which is only 35 watts. So, armed with this information, and knowing that there are two power toggles in the BIOS, PL1 and PL2, I clamped those to 35 watts. So this CPU that was ungodly hot now is clamped at 35 watts. It continues to run at 3.6 gigahertz under full all-core load, and all 16 threads will peak to 4.7 gigahertz. And consequently, with that massive cooler on it, it never exceeds ambient temperature of the room.
Wow. I don't think we've got time to talk about what you're actually doing with the thing.
Oh, I'm not going to talk about what I'm going to doing with it. This is okay. Just assembling the hardware in order to create a platform to build a home lab server. So what I've discovered is you can take these parts from the past that run hot. And there are actually controls to run them in a really low power configuration. This part is now running in the same sort of power profile that a laptop, you know, a reasonably spec'd laptop would run in. But it's got a massive 360mm all-in-one cooler on it. So consequently, it runs at ambient temperature, completely silent now, with bags of performance. So I'm optimistic for how I'm going to be able to use this into the future. And I've paired it with a single slot 30-watt bus-powered GPU to do some lightweight machine learning, because we've all got to have that in a home lab today.
Lightweight machine learning.
Yes.
Let's just let that sink in.
So I'll be talking more about how I'm actually using, what software I'm going to pile onto this thing in the future, but I'm going to touch on a number of things people know and some things that people don't in a future episode.